Over the weekend, crowds gathered on the plaza for what organizers called Stand Against Hate demonstrations, taking a stand against neo-Nazis and white supremacists carrying torches in Virginia, and in solidarity with counter-protesters who were attacked by a car, leaving one dead and 19 injured. The conversation about where we stand and what exactly this all means has been raging ever since. Some people have expressed shock that this could happen in 2017. Others say that's willfully naive. Some say, well, free speech isn't always pretty, and others say, nope, free speech stops with torches. President Trump's initial statements referencing hate on many sides rather than denouncing specific groups drew quick reproach. But there have also been calls for ordinary white Americans to make their own public denouncements of bigotry, racism, and white supremacy. Today on KCUR's Central Standard, we're taking the temperature in Kansas City. What are the conversations in your circles? Is there something not being said enough that you think we need to hear? Tell us how you're feeling at 816-235-2888. I'm Gina Kaufman here with Paku Herr and Justin Stein. They're both part of a group called Showing Up for Racial Justice. Paku, good morning.
Good morning.
And hello to you, Justin.
Hello.
So I want to get both of your sense of how people in Kansas City are responding to this weekend's events.
I have experienced people in several different places of my life experiencing what's happened in Charlottesville. There are the folks that I organize with who have their finger on the pulse of all things racial justice, who I would almost say are predictably angry and frustrated by this, irritated, upset, emotionally distraught. And then there are other people in my life who I would call moderates, fence sitters, people who have never been moved to take action on racial justice or perhaps any other political issue, who I'm seeing post on Facebook that, to varying degrees, some are shocked. Some are angry. Some are, in fact, rageful. Some are scared.
Can you describe the anger and rage? I mean, what is it about specifically?
I think that so there's anger and rage that people were hurt, that somebody was killed. So that is the immediate thing that people are reacting to. I have also seen this sort of undercurrent amongst my white moderate friends or my white moderate acquaintances, this anger about the fact that they didn't actually realize this was happening. And by this, I mean there's this as in the protest in Charlottesville that has, in fact, been planned brazenly and publicly for months by the alt-right, but also the this as in the big narrative about racism and that it's actually happening. And people, I've seen a couple people actually be quite angry by having an encounter experience with their own lives and themselves around whiteness and the fact that they're realizing now that they had never thought about it because of their whiteness, and their whiteness had shielded them. And so there's a new thread of anger that I think I see differently amongst fence sitters.
People who are frustrated on some level with an identity that they might be wrapped up in without realizing it. Is that what you're saying?
There's some of that. And just there's, like when you wake up and discover that something is not exactly what you thought it was, that's partly about your identity. It's partly about the stories that you learned or did not learn. It's partly about an awakening to what is real. All of this real stuff was happening around you and you didn't know, or you were taught not to know. So I think while there's some folks who are angry as if it's some sort of willful ignorance, I think perhaps there probably is some willful ignorance, but racism doesn't just work by willful ignorance, that folks are just taught not to know. And it's much more complicated than a willful decision to not know. And so I have seen that. The anger emerging around this kind of like, oh my God, moment for people where they've seen something quite differently about not just the world, because I don't think you have to scratch really hard. And you didn't have to scratch hard a year ago, 10 years ago, 20 years ago for people to really admit that racism is still a problem. But there's a different sense now, I think, for a lot of people, given the political moment in the racial landscape.
Do you think it's a surprise that racism exists, or that racism in this form is not only exists, but is common enough to be what that looked like? You know what I mean?
Totally. I think it's not so much that racism exists, but that racism is this bad.
Right.
That it really is this bad. People of color, communities of color, white racial justice activists have been saying this for generations. But we are in a different political climate. We have folks in Congress and we have folks living in the White House who espouse the same white supremacist ideologies. And so I think there is I don't even know how else to describe it other than a ripeness to see something that has always been there.
You know, because you're talking about your white moderate friends, and because there's a lot of importance right now being placed on self-identifying.
Totally.
I'd like you to just sort of identify who you are and where you come from on this.
Sure. So I am a first one and a half generation Asian American. My family came here as refugees. My family fought for the United States in the CIA's secret war in Southeast Asia, which is the war that was happening at the same time as the Vietnam War. That's why it was called the secret war. Nobody knew about it. And a lot of our tribal communities in Laos and Thailand and Vietnam were engaged with the United States and, in fact, were soldiers. And so my family came here with that history. I'm the only person in my family born in the United States. And I come from a family of activists, political activists, cultural activists, and found myself doing racial justice work as a student organizer, and spent time in my community working with community groups, and then have spent about the last 20 years doing racial justice work in different places and in different ways, building grassroots power, but also working with people who live and do life, who are saying these institutions keep reproducing racist outcomes. If it's my school or my church or work, and we need help trying to figure out how to produce a different outcome. We don't intend for this to happen, but it keeps happening. That's the realm where I did a lot of training and coaching and leadership development around anti-racism work.
I'm going to turn your personal response to what happened this weekend.
So interestingly enough, there were several people that I know all across the country asking one another, what are you doing? Just what are we going to do? Because I think there are strategic and organizing answers that we always come to. But I decided, it's funny, I had actually taken the last month off. I did a media fast, so, and in politics, so it was very hard to do that. But I did that for a month, and then I just came back, really sort of threw myself back into mainstream media and following that and tracking that about 2 weeks ago.
So this was a warm welcome.
This was incredibly exhausting. But I decided this weekend that my response was to check in on the people that I know we're struggling, given what happened. I know people who are in Virginia, to just do the basics of what it means to take care of myself and my family. Feed us, love us, hug it out, be together. It was not, some maybe might say it was an escape from what was real. I was still watching the news and still talking to people. But that was how I responded, because I think it's very easy in moments like this to succumb and to just submit to what feels absolutely horrifying. It is still horrifying. And I'm not particularly useful as an organizer if I succumb to that.
Well, also, I'm curious how spending that time with your children, I mean, looking at a child in the context of all of this has a particular kind of feeling, I think.
It does. It's especially saddening to think about the world as it is and raising my children. My spouse and I have also always been very, very open with them about race, racial politics, identity development. They're children of color. And so we talked about it. We talked because one of them had just had this sense that I was sad, my younger daughter. And she said, Mommy, why are you sad? Like, you seem really upset. And I told her, and we talked about it. And then...
Wait, what did you tell her?
I told her that there were people who had gathered, white people who had gathered in a state far away that were gathering because they don't believe that brown people and black people and Native people and Muslim people should be here. And that they believe that white people are better than everybody else. And she immediately said, are they the same people who voted for Donald Trump? So there were, you know, there are conversations we've had. I mean, my child, she's 7 today. Today is her birthday. And she's fully capable of drawing those connections herself because we talked about the election. And while they're children of color, my spouse is white. And so they ask questions about, well, does this mean daddy doesn't believe those things? And we say, not all white people believe that. But these white people who were out there and who hurt people, and a white person who was upset about this, killed somebody. Very, very open about it. And in fact, yesterday, my other daughter, who's 9, told me that they talked about it at school, which I'm really thankful for. Because for her, for my children, about race, what I would call white supremacist ideology, in developmentally appropriate ways, given their cognitive ability. But I'm not going to not talk about it with them, because I think that will do run to pretend this isn't happening and to raise children in a world and pretend that these horrific things aren't actually happening.
Justin Stein, tell me a little bit more about who you are and what you bring to this conversation. You personally have been responding to these events.
Sure. white, heterosexual male. I'm involved with showing up for racial justice and have been involved in doing racial justice work with a focus on trying to move white people into the struggle to fight and combat racism and white supremacy for about 10 years or so now. I come from a labor union family. Day job is actually with a statewide organization that focuses on workers' rights and economic justice. I think with with showing up for racial justice after the event in Charleston, we immediately began, our Facebook page started blowing up and people started asking, what's going to happen? What are we going to do? And that's actually pretty normal. There's been a number of high-level racist incidents over the past year or so since we launched our group that have warranted a response. And so I think, sort of to Paku's point, I think there's been a mixture of shock and fear and sadness among white people and people of color who pay attention to what is going on in our country as it relates to racism and racial inequality. I think that for some folks, there's also been, sadly, for many folks, a recognition that this is not an anomaly, that what happened in Charlottesville is actually predictable. And what happened in Charlottesville is not an example of the system not working. It's actually an example of the system exposing itself for what it is in a very raw, brutal way. And so I think while the image of white people, mostly white men, there were white women in the crowd as well, but angry white people marching with torches, committing acts of terrorism and violence, shocks all of us. That image is very shocking. It is not, it is part of a reality that exists for many people, communities of color dealing with this type of violence on a daily basis forever. It's not something new. What's new is the level of rage and hatred that so many people are able to see on display.
I want to turn to one of our callers, but I just want to observe that it seems to be like very emotional for you to talk about this.
Well, it is. I mean, so in showing up for racial justice, we believe that white supremacy, and frankly, we like to call it the death culture of white supremacy, is something that not only oppresses and harms and kills people of color, but that it also harms white people, and that white people on a spiritual, psychological, emotional level, in addition to a material level in many respects, but there is a spiritual sickness that plagues white America, and Charlottesville is an example of the choice we can make. Like so many other events that have confronted us with a choice that we can make, and that's either to join the struggle to dismantle and end white supremacy or remain complicit with it through our silence. And I think our silence is what is killing us.
I want to talk to our caller, Bill from Prairie Village at 816-235-2888. Hi, Bill.
Hello. Just want to make an observation that my late brother made. A number of years ago, we used to go fishing in southwest Missouri, northern Arkansas, and on the drive from Cassville, Missouri to Eureka Springs, during President Obama's first term, we noticed an absolute proliferation of rebel flags. Every other farmstead seemed to have a Confederate flag, and Mike said this, the Civil War has never really ended. There's just been a 150-year ceasefire, and I'm afraid with the present situation in this country, and I mean from the President of the United States on down, the seeds have returned. I don't see a real happy outcome for this.
Can you tell me a little bit more about what it is you fear?
I think we're going to see civil strife. I think not only racial, you could see class strife. This election last year, to me, was never seen such division.
Well, Yeah, Bill's talking about his fears for the future, his sense that maybe we've just been on hiatus from the Civil War rather than having that behind us. But also, he's talking about really profound symbolism in this country that is also incredibly contentious in former slave states all over this country, Confederate symbolism. And I wonder how integral you think that is to this conversation, particularly in Missouri.
I think it is. I think Bill is correct that the symbolism matters and the symbolism has deep, deep meaning, because in order to understand what the rebel flag means, what the Confederate flag means, we have to step back and say, what's the cultural significance of that? That it's not just, you know, people say, but it wasn't just the culture of the South. I mean, the culture of the South was slavery, colonization, war. That is what it symbolizes. And it's also a clear, you can't just say, oh, well, it was, you know, we're celebrating a geographical part of this country when we hang that flag, without it also bearing all the other meaning. And I think, you know, Bill is correct to say that, you know, civil strife and the struggle here is very real. It has been real for a long time, and I think I agree. It's only been on hiatus, or we thought it was on hiatus.
We have to take a short break. This is KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and we want to hear how Kansas City is responding to the weekend's events in Charlottesville, Virginia. Call 816-235-2888. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're talking today about the events over the weekend in Charlottesville, Virginia, a white supremacist rally that ended up inciting a level of violence that resulted in 19 people injured and one dead. People are responding to this all over the country, including in Kansas City. We've heard about demonstrations in solidarity with counter-protesters who suffered that violence. And we want to hear from you, 816-235-2888. You know, we were just talking about Confederate symbolism. I'm also kind of curious about the issue of there being kind of different forms of racism, whether that's something that I know some people don't see that as a legitimate viewpoint, that racism is racism and that it's just as dangerous in its sort of subtle forms as it is in its overt and violent forms. But is this one spectrum of, you know, people with some racial bias that operates at a subconscious level, but basically well-intentioned people to people carrying torches and threatening their fellow human beings? Is this a spectrum, or are they two different animals?
So I think it's important to start, in my opinion, and from the opinion of Showing Up for Racial Justice, from the premise and sort of from the basis that we talk about racism in the United States, we're talking about a system of white supremacy that is embedded in every aspect of our culture and in every institution and aspect of our economy. It is everywhere, and it very much is. When we talk about racism, it's not just about racial animosity. It's about creating a system and a culture and a society that is built around the supremacy of this identity of whiteness, and that is what we are organized around as a country. And I think that that manifests in a variety of ways. And so what we saw in Charlottesville, in my opinion, is the result of the same system that is resulting in an attack currently on immigrants. Today, there's a rally at 6 p.m. over at the Vietnam Veterans Memorial Park, held by the Kansas-Missouri Dream Alliance, who are demanding that we protect the DACA program, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. It protects about 800,000 young people from deportation. And so the attack that we're seeing on immigrants that has been sustained for a long time now is a manifestation of the same system that produced Charleston. And it's a manifestation of the same system that has encouraged the president to encourage police officers to abuse suspects and to public support of a ban on Muslims. So, you know, white supremacy is everywhere. It manifests in a variety of ways. I think we have to be clear on that.
Yeah. One of the analogies that I have often thought about, I mean, I've done anti-racism training and organizing for 20 years, and I could have the best most impressive sociological conversation about what that means with big words and all kinds of stuff. But the truth is, when I think about white supremacy, I think about it as an ideology. And so then people are like, well, what does an ideology mean? It means like it's a virus and everybody is sick from it. But everybody, like, let's say everybody has the same virus, but the virus doesn't present itself the same way in everyone. Some viruses, some people catch a virus or get sick and they present with almost no symptoms, but they still have it because it's what everybody has. Some people exhibit incredibly horrific symptoms of the virus, may need to be hospital and almost die from it. That if we imagine an analogy like that to understand that it's the water that we all swim in. So an ideology is something that everybody participates in. Like you can't have been socialized. I mean, I'll say I have not yet found a single person. I've met thousands of people across the country doing training and organizing on this issue. You can't have been socialized in any way around race in the United States and not have somehow internalized some of this dominant message around whiteness is better, whiteness is superior. That goes for white people and people of color. So when I was thinking about this ahead of time, you know, another analogy to help people think about this is that, like, white supremacy is a chess game and everybody is a chess piece. But not every chess piece moves the same way, and not every chess piece has the same purpose, and not every chess piece does the same thing. So I might be a knight on the board, but I can only move a particular way. But I can move, and I do move, and I have to move in order to participate. Whether I like it or not, that's my role. And so I think this is the place where we can have some really rich conversation, the kind of conversation people are afraid to have. If we can say, from an ontological perspective, that is like, I'm not here to blame anybody for what's happening. We're trying to just be real about the lay of the land and about how race works here. That allows us to have a conversation about white racist ideology that engages everybody, including me as a person of color. Because white racist ideology isn't just people in pointy white hats carrying torches or screaming about how much they hate people of color. Like, as you know, I may be a person of color, and there are plenty of us who are Asian Americans who participate in anti-blackness, which is part of white supremacist ideology. There are plenty of us who participate in colonial history, which is part of white supremacist ideology. Like, it's much more complex than just finding the one bad racist. And instead understanding that really, if we were to look at racism, it's like it's a prism. And when it goes through, the beams of light come out, but every beam of light comes through that prism.
Can I just, the chessboard analogy, the struggle that I have with that analogy is that it is predetermined how each piece will move. And that piece is never going to change. Like, it's never, you're never going to get a rook to move in some new way. And that seems a little bit hopeless, like that people, I'm curious whether you think people can learn to respond differently and to behave differently and what that takes.
Yes. So without a doubt, people can respond differently. I use that analogy to help us understand the starting point. Like, in order to sit down and say we're going to try some strategies to change something, then what's the language? What's the framework? What are the ways that we're going to help one another understand where we're really starting? So I don't offer that as an immovable game or as a game where we couldn't break the entire board into tiny bits and do something else. But if I were to work with people who wanted to have this conversation, who are desperate to change something but don't understand how the game is even structured, then we're at a real loss for coming up with some solutions that will work. So I do think, and I have seen people be radically transformed in the work that I've done in ways that I never expected, in ways that demanded that I suspend my own prejudices about what I thought the outcomes would be.
You know, Justin, just quickly, if we're thinking about this as a game of chess, who makes the next move? Who is it time for to step in and do something here?
Well, I mean, I think it's time for all of us. I mean, we Paku's point about how we're all socialized within a culture and sort of ideology of white supremacy. I mean, I will speak specifically to, I think, the call to white people, sort of to my point earlier that, you know, Charleston is yet another example. It's among a variety of examples that I think over the past couple years have caused more white people to question what is going on. And have caused more white people to want to get involved. And I think, again, white people are confronted with a decision to make. Are we going to join the struggle to fight white supremacy with our brothers and sisters of color? Or are we going to remain complicit with it in our silence?
Let's talk to Chase in Kansas City. Hi, Chase.
Hi there. I just wanted to say how, number one, supportive I am of showing up for racial justice and my regret that I haven't gotten more involved with the group. I think it's great. I wanted to share my hope that in Kansas City, any future protests that we have by various groups be peaceful and nonviolent in responding to white supremacy and neo-Nazis and the alt-right and all that sort of stuff. I was really disturbed, of course, by the white supremacists in Charlottesville, but by a few of the counter-protesters who showed up ready to fight with them. So-called anti-fas or anti-fascist groups. And I just think that that only gives the white supremacists cover and an excuse to keep doing what they're doing. And what really calls them out and shames them are when groups show up peacefully and nonviolently to demonstrate that we don't accept their violence and won't stoop to their level. And so the clergy groups and peaceful counter-protesters and Charlottesville are the ones that really gave me hope. And my hope going forward is that we as a culture, we as a city will never descend to where these white supremacists are terms of their violent tactics.
Thank you, Chase. And let's hear now from Diana. Diana is calling us from Platte County. Hi, Diana.
Hi, I appreciate your topic so much because I've watched this. I watched the news last night and was just in tears, but I wanted to share something that I did as a result, and these are things I think each one of us can do. I'm a white woman that lives in Platte County, and I was at the grocery store on Sunday afternoon, and two Muslim women came in, one in a full burqa, which is not something you see often in Kansas City, and certainly you don't see much in Platte County. And a couple of people were giving them looks. And finally, I pushed my card up to them and I introduced myself. I extended my hand and I said, I want you to know you are welcome in our community. And I thank you for bringing diversity to our community and our country. And I want you to know I'm your friend. And the woman didn't say anything. Both of them just smiled. And the one I extended my hand to patted my hand and squeezed it very tight. And so that's what I'm doing. And I think that's something we can all do, no matter what piece of the chessboard we're on. And that's what I'm doing as a result of this horrible ugliness that has overtaken our country.
Diana, thank you for that call. I wonder how our guests respond to how Diana handled that situation.
Oh, so yeah. So I mean, I think I think it's important that we all in our everyday lives make sure that people feel welcome and safe. You know, I think there's been some helpful bystander intervention trainings that have gone forward, especially when people of color, people who are identified as immigrant, or people who are identified as Muslim, are facing attacks in public spaces, what we can actually do to confront and disrupt that. You know, and I think the emphasis has always been on engaging the person who's under attack and asking them specifically, like, are you okay and what do you need? And you know, sort of how can I be here for you? And so I think we need to be, you know, cognizant of how to disrupt those types of situations. And I will say, I think, you know, we need to be doing work on a variety of levels. I think we need to be doing work on ourselves. We need to be doing work within our communities. We need to be challenging other white people in our lives around these issues. And we need to be...
If we are white.
If we are white, yeah. And we need to be organizing, and we need to be engaged in the policy arena and the political power building arena. The white supremacists in Charleston have publicly said that they're seeking political power. They're running for office. Ted from Missouri, who didn't want to give his last name because he wants to run for office in Missouri. We need to be clear that there is an agenda that has achieved a level of governing power.
I want to just get back to Diana's scenario, though, a little bit. I mean, she did something to extend friendship to a person who was under sort of silent scrutiny, I guess I would describe it. Is there something else that you would recommend doing in addition or instead, or is that exactly like...
So I think that what she did was great as a way to offer hospitality and consideration and to let herself be revealed as somebody who that person is safe with. The thing that I would suggest for her and for others is also to ask oneself, what is the question to have with the person pushing that cart? Because I think there are ways in which folks can come and be...
The person expressing racism?
Expressing racism, yes. The person in that scenario who was expressing the racism or acting out what she observed as their bias. But I think there are really, really critical conversations to have there, too.
Paku Herr, Justin Stein, both with us from Surge or Showing Up for Racial Justice. Thank you for sharing what you're seeing and hearing in Kansas City.
Thank you.
I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we'll come back to this on future shows. Email us if there's a focus that you'd like to hear us take. centralstandard@kcur.org. We are back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and now we're visiting the city market and how it's changing. 20 years ago, my family had a little bookstore on Delaware Street, one short block from the market. The only other shops on the street at that time were a Function Junction, a kayak store, and an art gallery. Otherwise, all the storefronts were closed and there was no foot traffic Monday through Friday. Even just a couple of years ago, you could breeze right into a parking spot in the off hours, no problem. But now it's a whole different story. The place is packed, and not just on weekends, over lunch and beyond. Is that a good thing? Share your River Market story at 816-235-2888. We'd especially love to hear from longtime residents and people who work in the area. 816-235-2888. Kevin Collison is with us. He reports on development for KCUR. Hi, Kevin.
Good morning, Gina.
What's happening on the development side of things that might be underlying a lot of change people are talking about just anecdotally?
Well, there's a couple of things happening right now. As you point out, it's a far, far more busy area than it used to be even 5 or 10 years ago. But what we've seen is two things contributing to that. You've seen an amazing influx of apartment developments. There are several projects that have been either recently completed or are in the works right now that have added a lot of new residents down there. And also, oddly enough, the streetcar has been kind of a mixed blessing in that it's a wonderful, wonderful way for people to get around. It's attracted a lot of people to use it. But it's also now a situation, from what people tell me in the River Market, that people who work downtown are parking their cars in the River Market area and hopping on the streetcar to get to their jobs in the Central Business District, which is clogging up the parking situation for people who want to go to the business there or live there. And in fact, the city right now is beginning a program in which they're investigating putting meters in and trying to find out ways to prevent that from just becoming a park and ride situation for people using the streetcar. But again, I'm not putting the streetcar down at all. It's been a huge factor in helping make it one of the most attractive places to live downtown.
There's also, it seems like there's kind of like a weekend program that a lot of people are on of driving either to Union Station and riding the streetcar to the city market and back, or the flip flop of that.
Mm-hmm. No. And again, that's actually a very positive thing, is because, yeah, people do use the streetcar. They park over at Union Station or somewhere along the route and use that to get to the city market, which is probably as popular now as it's ever been. I mean, it's still my favorite thing to do on a Saturday morning in Kansas City, is to go to the city market. It's the best people watching. It's just a great environment. And yes, you're right. People are using that to get to the city market, although I know that the folks in the River Market would love to see people do more of that instead of circling around trying to find the few parking spaces that are available on a Saturday morning.
Talk to me more about the residential piece of it, because I guess, I mean, I realize that it is a popular place to live and a real... Yeah, there's a draw for that neighborhood.
Yeah.
I hadn't realized that a lot of the activity down there was among residents. Like, I guess I assumed that most of that activity was still people coming in for shopping or entertainment or whatever.
Well, just, you know, a quick background. You know, for a long time, most of the residential down there was in historic buildings that had been rehabilitated, both along Delaware and along, I think, 3rd Street, et cetera. About 8 years ago, an outfit out of Texas came in and developed what they call Market Station, which is a big, big apartment project with several hundred units along 2nd Street. And since then, there's been at least three or four other apartment projects that have been built or have been announced. So I would be
on that same scale
in not several hundred units, but they're big buildings, big projects, 200 or 300. That one's probably by far the largest and probably the most ambitious and fascinating one is a project that Jonathan Arnold is doing down at 2nd Delaware, which I think is about 300 units, but it's also being designed to some very state-of-the-art, environmentally friendly, very energy-efficient standards. And so you've got a really interesting mix of new housing, and you've also got Nature's Own relocated their grocery store down there. It used to be on Main Street, and now they've opened up a new place, and so you're getting some of the services to help people who live down there.
So it sounds like this is coming, the sort of congestion or vibrancy, depending on how you view this, is coming from a lot of different directions, which in the world of urban planning, it sounds like exactly what you're supposed to want. It sounds like mixed use to me.
It's very much mixed use. And I think, you know, again, if there's any kind of an issue right now that people would like to get their hands around, it is the parking situation. The city right now, for example, is working with the developers of an apartment project down there to create a couple of more sites on parking lots on the south side of Main at about 5th Street and make that available for an apartment and retail development. And they would provide parking then on a lot that's on the west side of the city market itself. And a lot of people are thinking that's going to be trying to jam a lot more cars into an area that's already seeing some serious congestion. So there's some call there now these days, similar to what we've heard about Westport, is let's take a step back and come up with some kind of a more comprehensive plan for how we want to see the river market evolve. Right now, we're just still kind of responding to development opportunities. Maybe it's time with the streetcar, with all this increased housing, with the popularity of the city market, and with this gentleman from Denver who we wrote about the other day, who's bought a lot of properties up with some very ambitious plans. It's time to take a look at, are there some things we should be doing to help prevent problems from building up?
Is there a tipping point for the neighborhood's desirability? I mean, can the congestion start working against that? Are there people probably like thinking about moving now that the sort of quiet walk to the market for some vegetables on a Saturday morning is not so quiet?
I don't know. It hasn't been quiet for a long time from what I know. But, I think as long as most of these projects do provide parking for the people who live there. So it's the people who want to visit that maybe it's getting to be a bit of a hassle. But I mean, if you're looking for, and I'm just a little biased here, because I do think if I was ever to move downtown, that'd probably be the neighborhood I'd love to go to, because the city market is like the old village square. It's such a great centerpiece for a livable, walkable environment. And again, the housing choices are becoming more and more varied. And you've got the streetcar now, which really allows you to not have to get into a car just to run every little errand you want to do. You can hop on it and go up to Cosentino's downtown or up to Union Station or up to the entertainment areas in the Crossroads and or the Power and Light District. So, you know, I think if the city stays a little bit ahead of this whole thing, I think the river market's going to be a very dynamic environment for the foreseeable future.
Well, as of a couple of years ago, there were concerns about air quality in this part of downtown. And with the influx of people, we wanted to check in on that. So Amanda Grayer is with us. She's the Air Quality Program Manager for the Mid-America Regional Council. Hi, Amanda.
Hi, good morning.
Tell me, first of all, talk about what the sort of concerns have been in the past, in the very recent past, about air quality in the city market.
So the last time we talked about air quality in the city market, the big concern was the Veolia District Energy plant that's down. You can see it from 3rd and Grand. It's technically at 1st and Grand, but it's a big formerly coal-fired plant that provides steam and chill water for venues like the Sprint Center and big big buildings downtown, and the there's benefits to district energy that reduces the need for HVAC, different types of units on the building itself. It provides those, so it frees up space on the buildings. However, it is very close to downtown and in the River Market neighborhood. So you have this old historic coal-fired plant right in the middle of this developing neighborhood. So about 7 years ago in 2010, the US EPA strengthened or tightened the standard for sulfur dioxide, which is one of six criteria pollutants. Ozone is another one. We talk a lot about ozone. And so sulfur dioxide is on the same list as ozone for these criteria pollutants that have health-based standards for them. So back in 2010, the EPA decided that they needed to strengthen that standard to better protect public health. And
what are some of the health consequences of sulfur dioxide?
Yeah, similar to pretty much any airborne pollutant. Anyone with respiratory conditions, it can aggravate emphysema, it can aggravate asthma. If you have more chronic exposure to it, you can develop respiratory and cardiac issues. Children and the elderly have specific hardship with those because children just breathe more pollution per pound of body weight, and the elderly have more ailments. And so it's
just these vulnerabilities.
Right, right. And so these are vulnerable populations that these public health standards are set to protect.
And okay, so what's changed? Has anything changed?
Absolutely. So this coal-fired power plant or the district energy plant, based on this change to the standard, they had to reduce their sulfur dioxide emissions, which were specific to the coal burning that they were doing. And earlier this year, they completely stopped burning coal. So they are no longer burning coal in the River Market at the Veolia plant. They switched to natural gas, and they are solely burning natural gas to generate the energy they need to send out the steam and chill water that they're doing. So on the development front, this also opened up where that giant coal pile was in the River Market. So there's a 4-acre site in the River Market that Veolia is looking to redevelop that no longer houses that pile of coal that they were forming. So it's not only an air quality benefit, but it did also open up some land in the market for redevelopment.
Wow. So that is a pretty big, that is a really significant change.
It's huge. Yeah.
What do you attribute that progress to?
So the tightening of that standard, so it didn't dictate how Veolia had to go about reducing their sulfur dioxide emissions. And there are other coal-fired plants all across the country that had to respond to this standard. But it doesn't dictate how, it just dictates how low the emissions have to go to meet that standard. And they decided as a company that that was how they were going to meet that standard. And so it was a public health push. Veolia as a company is also sort of an environmental company. The facility is also zero waste to landfill, and so they're doing other things at the facility to be more environmentally conscious with what they're doing in the River Market. But that standard, that switch was largely driven by regulatory decisions over the past 7 or 8 years.
So as people are moving in higher numbers and to the City Market and more apartment complexes are opening up and restaurants and businesses are seeing a lot of traffic. There's a lot of parking that is sort of unaccounted for maybe inside a lot of those businesses. And I'm also curious, is the cost of being part of that community going up in ways that are leaving some people out of the excitement?
Well, I think that there are still affordable apartments down there. I've not heard of anybody being forced out because it's getting too expensive. And I did want to, one thing that's good to add, Gina, and you talked about things to do for people. We had this story, it's on the website of KCUR, about this gentleman from Denver who's acquired a lot of properties along Delaware, which, again, in my opinion, is one of the prettiest streets in the city as far as late 19th century architecture. And he wants to really reinvigorate that street that you had mentioned earlier about how when you went there years ago, there wasn't much going on. He pointed out there's 30 to 40 doors along that stretch of the block, and only about a half a dozen to eight of them actually have merchants and businesses that people can go to. He wants to add quite a few more and really enliven that street, which, again, is just a lovely collection of wonderful old buildings. And right now it's not really all that popular as far as the, having businesses along there. You got the farmhouse restaurant, and you've got a couple of other good places along there. But he really wants to bring more energy. He also wants to develop, talk about parking. There's a parking lot that lies between some of the buildings. It's right behind the streetcar stop in the River Market, right along Delaware. He wants to put a building in there that would be kind of a marketplace building with roll-up doors, et cetera, that small vendors could be into. Again, all this is to enliven the street life there that makes it such a popular place for people to go. But, you know, obviously as rents go up, as congestion grows, there may be some folks who can't afford it or don't want to deal with it. But, you know, some people will say that's a good thing because it means that after many years of just neglect and not a lot of energy, this area has really become a dynamic part of our community.
So from an air quality perspective on that, as well as we're talking about parking, the River Market specifically is one of the it's fairly well transit served between getting to the streetcar and the 3rd and Grand transit stop. But there's also two new bike share stations that went in addition to the ones that were already there. And there's two zip cars that are located there that allow for hourly car sharing. So to a certain extent, the residential areas of the River Market, because of all the other transportation options that are there, allow people to live there and possibly not own a vehicle at all. So, you know, the cost of ownership of a vehicle is so high when you start looking at gas and parking and maintenance and insurance, right? All of these things that go along with the cost of owning a vehicle, you can potentially reduce your cost of living by living in a place that has all of these transit options and doesn't require you to own that vehicle and have it sit whatever percentage of the day you're at work or not using it. So, you know, the rents may be going up, but there may be opportunities there to reduce cost of living in other ways because of there are so many options to get around, including those hourly car shares if you have to get somewhere that transit or bike share can't get you.
And I was going to add on, there are also some exciting opportunities that might be in the future for the River Market to expand physically. As you guys have reported at KCUR, there's this serious discussion right now about downgrading the North Loop, the freeway that cuts the River Market off from downtown, to a more pedestrian-friendly environment, some kind of a parkway perhaps, that could add more land to expand
opportunities. So like lower speed limits,
lower speed limits, but also free up more land to be developed to add more to the population. And also there's a major push to extend the streetcar down to the actual river, to the Berkeley Riverfront Park, which would then, again, there's already a large apartment project going up near Berkeley Riverfront Park, but this would be yet another direction that development and activity could grow in the River Market. So it's really got a pretty fascinating future.
How much do you think Berkeley Riverfront Park kind of plays into this change? I mean, I've noticed going on walks there that more and more it used to be, again, like a pretty sleepy stroll. And now you see this really, I think, a pretty vibrant community of joggers, people with dogs. Like, it feels like a city place.
Well, you're seeing probably a reflection of all the people who are living in the River Market now. It's a great recreational asset. I mean, if you live there, you can walk down that main street, that overpass bridge that was built about 10 years ago and which hardly anybody ever used for a long time. And you can go down to the trail, which is a very nice trail that runs along the river all the way up to the Kitbon Bridge. And then now you're actually seeing some residential development going on next to the park itself. But it's a nice environment. It really is. If you like urban living and you don't want to feel like you're in a concrete type of confined environment.
You know, going back to the heart of the City Market, which would be the agricultural, like the produce and the vending of market goods right in the heart of it, it is interesting to me. I mean, I worked there as a vendor several years ago, and there was a rush. But other than that, it was really people who were just buying food. Is it more of a tourist destination than a functional market at this point, or is it still a very functional market?
I see a lot of people buying a lot of produce when I go down there, so I think it's all kinds of things.
Anyone here shop there, or no?
Oh, yeah,
oh,
absolutely.
Oh, yeah, no, yeah. My wife goes down there every Saturday morning at 7:30 a.m. Believe me, there's customers for that produce.
Well, that's good to hear. Our time is up. Kevin Collison, reporter for KCUR on development issues. Thank you so much.
Oh, you're very welcome,
and
Gina.
And Amanda Grayer with us from MARC. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Keep on talking on Twitter. We're at KCURCST. And if your neighborhood is changing and you want to talk to us about it, be sure and let us know. If you missed any of today's program, you can listen back at kcur.org/centralstandard. That's kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow, we're going to talk about the Netflix series Ozark, starring Jason Bateman. It's not exactly a tourism brochure for that region. If you have a personal connection to the Ozarks, we hope you'll call in with your review tomorrow at 10. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Andrea Tudhope, and Suzanne Hogan. With lots of help from intern Danielle Hogarty, I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next. Don't miss it.